Okay, after numerous complaints, Boston Mayor Tom Menino is considering a crackdown on aggressive panhandlers. Coming up, do you need a crackdown on panhandlers? And, more important, do you give when you are asked?
Years ago, Daniel Hernandez Jr. was hailed as a hero. He rushed to the aid of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was shot in broad daylight.
I appreciate the sentiment. I must humbly reject the use of the word hero because I am not one.
We look back on that tragic day in Tucson and to what's next for some of the people involved next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And Samets Blackstone Associates, for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. You can follow them on Twitter at SAMETZ.
You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7. I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.
Now, it appears Boston is about to follow in the footsteps of Worcester and crack down through fines and possible banishment what the mayor, a homeless advocate, calls rogue beggars. The city council is going to take up a, quote, aggressive panhandling ordinance next week. We want to know at 301-8970. Do you give, do you not give, and is a crackdown for safety, the city says. They say that's the reason. Is that meritorious? The woman who runs the women's lunch place, it's a day shelter, though she's speaking only for herself, is joining us. Susan Morong, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Hi, Susan.
Thank you.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us. I wrote about this whole situation today in the Boston Herald and spoke with you yesterday. You know, lots of people will say, well, I'm not going to give to that person because they're only going to go out and buy drugs or use alcohol. And I asked you about that as someone who deals with women who are going through the really tragic situation of homelessness. You gave me a great answer. What'd you say?
I said that when I make a decision to give to somebody, I also think that it's none of my business what they do to spend them, how they spend the money. That I'm giving because I want to give, and I need to not be concerned with what they do with the money.
Yeah, it's fine. I think you're the aberration. I think most people want a receipt for whatever it is that the money's being used for. Hey, Susan, describe who is the typical person on a street corner who's asking us for a buck or a cup of coffee or whatever? Who are those people?
Well, I can just talk about the women that we serve at the
sure.
women's lunch place. And many of the women, they're poor, they're living under the poverty level, or they're homeless. A lot of the homeless are homeless because they suffer from severe mental illness, and that's as a result of we deinstitutionalized all the mental health facilities in Massachusetts during William Weld's time here in Massachusetts as governor. And so most of these women, they're panhandling because, you know, the poverty rate's $13,000 a year. How do you live in the city of Boston
right. Living
on $13,000 a year? It's absolutely impossible to do. So a lot of the women that come to our place at Panhandle, they do it to supplement to be able to eat, to be able to just get the basic necessities that they need. They're not necessarily what you, I think, typically think of as a panhandler as being a drug addict and alcoholic. Now, I also want to say that I'm saying this based on the women that we serve. I know that might not be the case in the general and with all homeless people.
Well,
the
mayor's hotline has apparently received hundreds and hundreds of calls about dangerous panhandling, and that's why they're talking about this crackdown. But you understand the whole situation much better than certainly I do. Should there be a crackdown, or is this excessive? What do you think, Susan?
I think that, I read your article this morning, and I do believe that I can understand where people would be concerned, especially on the highways. They're stopped at a stop sign. There's no way to escape. And I've had my own experiences where I've been, somebody's been panhandling at night, and I've been with another woman, and I've been, scared.
Yeah.
because there's nothing you can do to really get out of the situation. So I do think in certain circumstances, and in particular if there's a spot where there's a number of panhandlers there all the time and they're being aggressive, that we ought to take some sort of action.
Hey, Susan Morong, thank you so much for your time from the Women's Lunch Place. We really appreciate it. Our number is 877-301-8970. Do you give? Do you say you give and not give, which is most people I know, by the way? They
really?
Yes.
I know someone who doesn't give as much as he should. Everybody at one workplace gave to this particular panhandler right off of 93.
Who might that be, Marjorie?
Well, you didn't give, Jim. You drove past him at 40 miles an hour every
day. I
had
to get to work in the morning. Let's go to Cambridge, which happens to be my hometown. And Kathleen is on 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Kathleen.
Hey, my hometown, too. Fourth generation. How about that?
Yeah. Do you give, Kathleen?
I do not. And it's like a soapbox for me. It drives me mad. I do give generously, I may say so, to a lot of the agencies that help out. My favorite includes Salvation Army in Cambridge, which is really great.
Yep.
And, you know, Rosie's Place, a lot of folks like that. But I just really see this as an enabling thing, first of all. And I know there's been a talk show years ago where agents from, you know, Pine Street and so forth were saying, please don't give money to the people on the street. Please, you know. Do it through organizations that really provide some long-term help. But beyond that, just as a resident of this area, and let me tell you, I live near Alewife Brook Parkway in Mass Ave. There are people who've been there for years, the same people all the time.
Yeah, but I mean, but the reality is, so what are you saying? They're scamming you, or that, where are you going with Kathleen?
For sure. I mean, not everyone is scamming, you know? There's all kinds of people out
there. Hey, Kathleen, are you familiar with the Dunkin' Donuts in Central Square?
Very.
I'm the opposite of you. I actually give, and one of my favorite moments, Kathleen, this is a true story, Marjorie knows this, about 5 years ago, I was feeling very charitable, and as I left Dunkin' Donuts, yeah. This is a true story, I dropped a quarter, and
a
guy who was holding a cup.
That's very charitable.
Well, that's all I had at the moment. I dropped a quarter, and the guy who was holding a cup, and the guy's response to me was, excuse me, that is my coffee. So actually, you have to be careful. I know, it's a painful story, but true. Kathleen,
thank you
very much for
the
call.
Kathleen. One of the things the mayor's office does say is that there are these sort of carpetbaggers who live in Brockton or they live in Easton and they drive to Boston.
But they're not the
well,
rule.
That's what they claim, that they're just scamming everybody. But on the other hand, you know, many people don't want to go to shelters. They don't want to. I interviewed this guy yesterday, 75 years old, mm-hmm. who's been panhandling by South Station now for about 15 years. He lives in the streets. He just wants money to occasionally get enough to, you know, get a good meal and go down for a big treat to Motel 6.
Let me tell you something. Based on recent developments, Marjorie, we could be doing this pretty soon, too. Where are we going next? What line are we going to? We're going to line to Michael in Norwood. You're next with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Jim, Marjorie, welcome to the party.
Thank you.
Hi, Michael.
I just wanted to make a couple comments on this subject because it's something that comes up a lot,
yep.
And it's going to come up a lot more now that this legislation has been proposed. I mean, I go in and out of Boston every day, and then basically I take a couple routes in. I do the VFW in and come through the back the Fenway, or I come off the expressway and through Chinatown. And I find that there tends to be generally, as the woman said before, the same people.
Yep.
They kind of stake out territory. So you get to know, I mean, you can make decisions and you can make a choice of who to give to based on their attitude and how they're you know, doing their job as they see it. And it's funny because over the years I've developed relationships with some of these people and, you know, talked about their children and their ailments. And can I tell a quick story?
Sure,
quick, yeah,
go
sure.
ahead.
I was in the alley in Boston. I was delivering something and I saw a gentleman probably around in his early 30s, and he was a pretty rough-looking guy, and he was bending down trying to find a half-lit, you know, half-burned cigarette so he could smoke it. And I was driving, and I was getting back to my car, and I showed him a cigarette, a whole cigarette, to give him, and he came over to the car, and we started talking, and he was telling me his story about how he got kicked out of a shelter because he fell off the wagon, and he was trying to get back, you know, and he asked me for some money, and I gave it to him, and he said, listen, I'm not going to buy drugs with this. And I said to him, I said, once this money is in your hand, it's none of my business what you do with it.
That's
the
Susan Morong school of giving, as
yeah.
we just spoke to a minute ago.
And hey. I think people either give or they don't. Just don't, you know, don't try to tell me one is better than the other. Do it or don't. Just don't. Don't preach to me
about
it.
But Michael, you know what? I think you hit on something really important, though. The attitude is a big thing. If someone comes up to you in a menacing way and, you know, is banging on your window, that's one thing.
Well, you know what the most menacing thing is? Is
what?
Those groups of guys with all the same color T-shirts on with buckets who are doing it for youth organizations.
Yes.
And they're in your face. They put the bucket in your car. And those aren't homeless people.
By the way, you think that's the most intimidating, Michael, because you've never been to Beacon Hill. Michael, thank you so much for your call. Let's go quickly out to Worcester, where Marie is on 99.7 WGBH. Hey, Marie.
Hi, Marie. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because my daughter, young daughter, is in recovery from heroin, and she knows a lot of the people, men and women, who are on the streets who panhandle. And as nice as some of them are, and she tells me their stories, a lot of them are panhandling because a lot of the people who go to a certain methadone clinic where she goes are still using.
Yeah.
And when they can't use, they go to the methadone clinic, and whatever money they make, they go and use with. So I feel that the clinics aren't doing adequate supervision of people. And in Worcester, you know, there's a huge heroin problem. It entraps so many people. And as I say, you know, it really doesn't make me want to give to anybody, as nice as they are, because I know this side of it, that in Worcester, a lot of it isn't alcohol, it's heroin, and they're using when they're not getting their dose.
Hey, Marie, we only have a couple of seconds. How's your daughter doing?
She's doing okay. She still struggles. She's very young, and she got caught up in it. You know, and she's one of those people who are really nice, and a lot of the people there are really nice, but there are a lot of people who are using while on methadone here in Worcester.
Yeah.
Marie, we got it.
On the street.
We wish her luck, and we wish you luck. Thank you so much for calling. We want to thank Susan Morong. She's the woman who runs Women's Lunch Place, which is a day shelter.
Well, now I guess we're moving on to what I call a different sort of giving. This new Panera Bread near City Hall is offering a unique and kind of ethically, fascinating way to pay for your food. Stay tuned to hear all about it.
Each day, All Things Considered brings you unparalleled insight into the latest news. We interview experts who have deep knowledge on topics of the day, who have the skills to explain. We unravel complex issues that sometimes seem too hard to grasp. I'm Melissa Block. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News, your appointment with excellence.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and New Repertory Theater presenting Marry Me a Little, a new take on Sondheim's musical review and on modern marriage at the Arsenal Center for the Arts, Watertown. More information online at newrep.org. And Precision Fitness Equipment, providing New Englanders with home and commercial exercise equipment since 1988. You can visit precisionfitnessequipment.com for a location near you. Precision Fitness Equipment.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7, and I am Jim Browdy.
And I'm Marjorie Egan.
You know, Panera-ophiles are used to paying pretty reasonable prices for a salad, a sandwich. Personally, I prefer the cup of chicken noodle with a half ham and Swiss extra mustard. It's my favorite. In downtown Boston, there's a whole new pricing structure about to go into place. A collection bucket is going to replace a cash register. You pay what you want. You pay what you can. By the way, the licensing board is having a hearing on this tomorrow. The man behind the idea of what's called Panera Cares, he's a Brookline guy. He's the founder of Panera. He now joins us on the phone. Good morning, Ron Shake.
Good morning, Jim. Listen, I got to talk to you about that ham and Hammond Swiss. We've got to get you into a new power spinach salad.
Well, I'm going to get there eventually. It's one step at a time, Ron.
So, I got it. We got to get progressive food here.
Yeah, exactly. Ron, thanks for joining us. So I'm just curious. Okay, you are running a very, very successful business. You know, the bottom line really counts. Why are you doing this, offering people the chance to give what they want to instead of what the sandwich or soup costs?
Well, you know, Panera's had phenomenal success. It's been one of the best performing restaurant companies of certainly the last decade. And much of that success is rooted in our engagement with communities. And we've always come from a place many call it conscious capitalism, but we start by trying to figure out how we can make a deposit. And when we do, we've tended to have great benefit for our shareholders. And I don't know, it was the height of the recession 3-4 years ago. We were watching a piece on NBC Nightly News in which they were talking about a group in Denver that had opened one of these cafes of shared responsibility, a community cafe. And they'd taken 10 years to open it. And my wife looked at me and said, heck, you guys do this all the time. You open a bakery cafe every 2 days. You've got 70,000 employees. You've got all kinds of equipment, you know. And I looked there and said, you know, if I had any guts, I'd go take a shot at it. And I said, you know what, I'm going to actually do it. And we spent a year studying it. We realized that I think for us internally, we give $100, $150 million a year in product away because we bake fresh every day. It felt like we wanted to use that product in a different kind of way and actually do it. And we started wandering around the country working in homeless shelters ourselves, and we realized we needed to bring positive energy to the experience.
And you, and by the way, and Ron, if I may, just to get – you've actually – this is not the first, the one that's going to be in Government Center, assuming the licensing goes well. You've done a handful. What do people do? Do they – what percentage pay the recommended price? What paid less? What? How many pay more? What's the deal? What's the breakdown?
Jim, it's amazing. This is the fifth one we'll open. I'm so excited because I'm doing it at home.
Yep.
It's the fifth one we're opening, and we will serve 1 million people in Panera Cares cafes this year. And it's hard to believe. It's a real study in humanity, but they're self-sustaining. They're in a nonprofit foundation. And on average, people leave about 80 cents on the dollar. What we say to people is, come in. We invite you in. Panera gives the cafe. We're going to spend over $1 million in this cafe. We give it to a nonprofit foundation. It's there. The only thing the cafe has to do is cover its food costs and its professional labor costs. And everything else that comes above that will stay in the foundation and be returned to the community. But we basically say, come on in. If you got a if you got extra bucks in your pocket, leave a little bit more, pay it forward for the next guy.
Ron,
leave a little bit less, and that will be fine.
But I just want to make sure I understand. You said they give 80 cents on the dollar, so that means they are leaving a little bit less on average?
Yes, on average, okay. People are leaving
a little bit less.
The way that's calculated, Marjorie, is 20% of people leave more. About 60% leave the suggested donation or retail value.
Uh-huh.
And about 20% leave less, but typically significantly less.
And I wonder if it matters where you are. If it's in a government center, obviously a lot of working people downtown. Also, a lot of the people we're talking about before, panhandlers and stuff like that. Does it matter if it's in a more affluent store location or not?
Well, we've tried to locate these in eclectic neighborhoods. Uh-huh. What we want, I mean, listen, you know, this is not curing hunger in America. This is an extraordinary problem. And food insecurity is affecting, you know, 1 in 6 in America, 1 in 4 kids. We're not going to solve it. What this is about is elevating the issue and raising it, and in some small way making a difference, and also challenging people to do the right thing and see if they will.
Hey, you're not
the reason we chose this location is because you've got both the people that can afford to support it and the people that have the need. And so it's a good eclectic neighborhood.
So you won't be opening one in Dover. That's the bottom line. Now, Ron Runshake,
nice
one last question for
his mother must be very proud.
Hey, Ron.
Maybe not even Cambridge, Jim.
Brookline, that's close enough.
But that's perfect because that's my final question for you. Here's what I fear in a moment of great self-awareness, a moment that I try to avoid as often as possible. I worry I'm going to go in with the best of intentions. I'm going to see a $7 chicken noodle soup and ham and Swiss or a salad, whatever you get me to eat, combo. My intention is going to be to pay 10 bucks. I'm going to look around, and I'm going to only leave three. I mean, I'm serious. Don't you worry about the best of intentions running awry when the rubber hits the road?
Hey, Jim, when I opened the first one now 3.5 years ago, that was the question. What would people do?
Yeah.
The reality is that we greet everybody at the door. We try to explain to them what this is about.
I love this.
And the reality is most people are fundamentally good. They do the right thing. Does that mean there aren't jerks? Sure. But most people actually get it. They understand this is a nonprofit. They understand that we're not benefiting in the least from it. It's really a pay forward for other people, and they do the right thing.
You're going to heaven, Ron Shaikh. Let me tell you that. Ron
I don't
Shaikh,
know about that. But.
Brookline guy and the founder of both Panera and Panera Cares. Ron, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate
it. Thank you, guys. Come down and visit us.
We'll do it. We'll be there. We're going to take your calls at 877-301-8970. In a minute, would you pay? How much would you pay? Does an endeavor like this have a shot in Boston? In studio, while we're waiting for your calls, to tell us whether anybody's going to pay is Suffolk University Associate Professor of Marketing Management and the author of one of the great name books of our time, The Myth of the Ethical Consumer. Good morning, Gianna Eckhart. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for
love
having me.
Love the title, I should say.
Thank
okay.
you.
So, Gianna, is the ethical consumer just a myth? I mean, Ron says that a lot of people, well, 20% of people, so that's not a lot, are paying more. The rest are in the middle. The rest are less. 80 cents on a dollar. They're not overpaying at Panera. What do you make of this?
The numbers that Ron mentioned don't surprise me. What tends to predict how much consumers will pay in a situation like this is the social norm, not necessarily the ethical belief. So in other words, if everyone in the store is paying $7 for their combo lunch, people feel embarrassed socially to pay less if they have the $10 mm-hmm. in their pocket and they can afford to pay for it. So those types of social norms will dictate behavior. So it doesn't surprise me that the majority of consumers, the 60% that Ron mentioned, would be paying about what the average price is.
Now, I would think you'd do a lot better if you had a big glass cubicle right by the cash register so everybody could see, you know, what you were putting in. You know, it's like at Catholic Church when they pass around the hat. If you're putting a 20 in there on a Sunday morning, you want to kind of flash that 20 around, you know, as opposed to the dollar bill. Would that make a difference?
That's a great example. And if you go to museums where the amount that you pay is a donation or optional, like the Museum of Modern Art in New York, for example, that's exactly what they do.
They do?
They do.
Glass cubicle?
Yes. So you can see what other people are paying because that tends to, as I mentioned before, dictate how much you would pay.
We're talking to Gianna Eckhart from Suffolk University. She's written a book called The Myth of the Ethical Consumer. It seems to me, and we should have asked Ron this, but I was dying to talk to you, is even if they only make 80 cents on a dollar, and I assume that means they roughly break even, they're not losing money, they're just not making as much, the public relations value of this, it seems to me, is huge. If you're not a Panera customer, which I am, and you hear about this, you say, hey, that's the kind of place I'm going to choose, maybe rather than X or Y. That doesn't do that. That's a fair statement, is it not?
Yes, I agree with you that it has a lot of brand building potential and that that's going to be
I meant to say brand building potential, by the way, but go ahead.
And that it's going to benefit Panera, the corporation, as compared to the nonprofit quite substantially, I think.
Our number is 877-301-8970. By the way, you have to raise your right hand when you call and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth. You go into Panera Cares, assuming it opens at Government Center. The licensing board hearing is tomorrow. The price for the thing you want is $6.
Wait a minute.
How much do you drop in the bucket?
Let's put it in the real terms here. We have the bacon turkey Bravo for $7.19.
How much is it?
$7.19. We have the steak and blue cheese chopped salad for $8.59. Now, say you got the steak and blue cheese, Gianna, and you walked up to the big cubicle. It's $8.59. Do you think you throw in the 10 spot and leave it there?
That's an interesting question.
Longest pause before an ethical question that has ever happened on radio. So what's the answer?
Well, let me say this. I would hope that I would.
Yeah.
But what tends to dictate how much people pay in those individual situations is contextual variables. So do you have a 10 in your pocket or do you have a 5 and 2 ones? And, you know, are you in a rush? Or how much did the person in front of you pay? All those types of contextual variables that don't necessarily affect you consciously.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's unconsciously. So I would like to say that I would.
You know what I also think matters, at least to me, especially at Christmas time, when I've gone shopping, you know, for my kids who already have too much that they don't need, and I've spent like $300, I've gone to the Apple store and I've gone to, you know, Banana Republic, wherever it is, spending these ridiculous, then I feel as though, God, I should be giving, I shouldn't feel so cheap. This is only $10 as opposed to the $100, the $200 I've just spent. Your whole shopping, doesn't that matter that day? How much you spent elsewhere?
Yes, that is a great example of a contextual variable. If you've just come from going on a shopping spree yeah. for yourself or your family, that will definitely affect how much you put in as compared to you've just paid your bills. And that puts you in a different frame of mind, right?
You know, so my goal is to use the term contextual variable in a sentence before you leave mm-hmm. the studio. I think I can do that, Gianna. I think I can.
I have faith in you.
Let's go to a Stoughton. Are we going to Stoughton first? I believe we're going to Stoughton, where Michelle is on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Good morning or good afternoon or whatever, Michelle.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
How are you?
Great.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm calling. I'm currently a Boston pedicab driver. We have a very similar policy. It's a pay you think that is worth kind of strategy. And just based on my personal experiences, I found that people do, you know, when they see human service or they feel like a moral characteristic to a service, they tend to pay what they think it's worth, and they won't really gyp you, based on my personal experiences and most other experiences.
That's very hardening, Michelle.
The pedicab is where you ride the bike and the people are sitting behind you, and you're basically physically driving them around. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, the green tricycles.
I think you'd feel very badly.
Hey, Michelle, it's a rotten connection. Thank you for the call, though.
The person's right in front of you. How could you, especially after you're working up a sweat in the summertime, driving them around Boston, coming, you'd have to give them a good piece of change.
You know, Gianna, you know what I just thought of in the context of this, why I heard Michelle speaking a second ago? Let's talk tips for a second, which I think is a variation on a theme. It's a contextual variable. I know it doesn't fit there. I wanted to say it. How many people, when they're about to give a tip, like at a coffee joint, wait until the person who is working behind the counter gets to see that they're putting the buck or the 50 cents. Almost, you can see
the majority of people
waiting.
Yes.
And what is that about? I mean, how does that fit within the whole notion of our goodness, our willing to give? What does that say? What's the statement there?
It says that we want other people to know that we're good people.
Exactly.
So if no one is watching, what is the usual response?
That's where I was going.
If no one is watching, people would pocket it, the majority of people.
They
not
would.
Everyone.
And which means if no one is watching, this is what I was trying to say to Ron Shaikh, the head of Panera, a couple of minutes ago. I worry that I'm the kind of person, if no one's watching, I go in with intentions to drop a 10, and I end up dropping a 2. I mean, isn't that...
Well, that's exactly what
don't laugh at me, Marjorie.
That's exactly what the book is about. And the point that we make is there is no ethical consumer. There's not some person out there who's a wonderful person and you.
Thank you very much.
But that each person will behave differently, sometimes ethically, sometimes not, based on all the different types
context,
of scenarios.
That's the whole deal, exactly.
But what about your own financial situation? How much does that play into it? If you are, you know, flush, if you're someone that's one of the 1%ers or even one of the above $400,000 people a year that the government's going to take more taxes out of now. Are those people more likely to
get... Well, can I give
someone...
even a better example? Let's say you work for a radio station, the radio station flipped to music, for example, and you didn't have a show anymore. And let's go to Lisa in Roslindale. Lisa, you're on WGBH, Boston Public Radio, with Gianna Eckhart, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Lisa.
Hi.
Go ahead. What do you think, Lisa?
What's up?
Well, the truth is I'm a starving artist, and I feel that I will pay it forward when I can.
Mm. Yeah.
I think it's awesome that I can, you know, have a place to go if I'm running kind of low, I can go there and still get a sandwich. And then later when, you know, I am flush or whatever, when I get a big gig or something like that, I can go back and pay more. And I think people like me actually do that because, like, someone loaned me $10 to get breakfast this morning, mm-hmm. and I gave the whole $10, even though it wasn't worth $10, to the waitress.
Oh, wow.
What kind of art do you do, Lisa? What do you do?
I'm a musician. I teach music and I perform.
Good luck
to you.
I
was going to say
Lisa,
that's a familiar refrain, you know, when I have more money, then I'm going to give more money. I think lots of people think they're going to do that, and then they don't. But you didn't answer my question, though, Gianna, and I'm curious. Do rich people give more? Or do poor people give more? Does it not make a difference? Or do people in the middle? Or is it just about your own personal generosity?
it has more to do with your own personal generosity. You would assume that people who had more to give would give more, but that's not, the research has not borne that out. There's not a correlation between demographic variables like income and the percentage of what you give. And actually, oftentimes, people who can relate to more of the bottom socioeconomic scale, like perhaps our last caller, will tend to be more generous, which is exactly the example she just gave.
Because they know what it means. They appreciate what it means. Our number is 877-301-8970. You're listening to Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan and Gianna Eckhart from Suffolk. Two of us are sitting in today at Boston Public Radio. How widespread is this thing? I know there are other, Ron Shaikh, who's in the food business, mentioned from Panera, mentioned there were others before him, even though nothing as big as Panera's. I'm thinking as I'm sitting here, does Macy's decide at one of its stores, I'm serious, that you pay what you want for a winter coat? Does a sporting goods store say you pay what you want for, I mean, whatever. I guess that's not a good example because it's not a necessity. But let's talk about clothes for a second. Has anybody done that there? Would it work? I mean, what's the deal?
No, I would be very surprised to see Macy's, for example, adopting this. One of the only other examples I've seen of this is with music. So there are different artists, and Radiohead is a big example, who says, pay what you'd like for our album, what you feel like it's worth. And let me say that they haven't repeated that experiment.
Is that so?
They really,
did
what
that
happened?
On iTunes or something when the new CD came out a couple
and
of years
happened?
Ago.
And what happened?
There were a lot of people who actually did pay some money, which, given the propensity to download music for free, was surprising in and of itself, but not as much as if they had bought it at the regular price.
You know, I have read, and correct me if I'm wrong because you're the expert on this, that the South, generally speaking, because it's more the Bible Belt, people more religious there, tend to give more than people in the North. We're not particularly generous in Massachusetts. Is that about people worrying that, you know, they'll be slayed by God if they don't give enough money? Or what's that about?
I think you're absolutely right to say that different cultural variables do affect this. And I think oftentimes religions have the notion of tithing built into the belief system, that you should be giving a percentage of what you earn, you know, back to society. So people who adhere strictly to those types of rules do tend to give more to charitable organizations.
So what's the future for this thing? Panera, he was fairly modest. From what I read this morning, the most profitable chain of its kind in the United States of America from 2000 to 2010, Ron Shaikh's Panera. They know their business. They know how to do business. And whether it's, I mean, he is a former community organizer. It sounds like it's the real deal. But let's assume another business says, this is great public relations for me. It's sort of like when you hear advertisers on the radio and TV, they never mention their product except at the end when they say, we give to the Boys and Girls Club. Please contribute to so-and-so. What's the market for this? It seems to me there's huge potential of goodwill that comes back to you, no?
I agree completely. And I think when you're a company like Panera that has the deep pockets that they do because of their success, they can afford to do an experiment like this. It will bring them great advertising and PR benefits. And even though they probably will only see a small percentage of the people who come in, you know, giving more or giving substantially, they still will see some people doing that. So I think it's a win-win for both people like our last caller, as well as Ron from Panera and the community.
Okay, we're talking about Panera Bread. They're going to open this new Panera down by Government Center in Boston, and they're going to allow people to come in and pay not the price for their whole grain breakfast power sandwich, which, by the way, is $3.89.
I've had that.
They can pay whatever they want for that sandwich. We're asking you guys what you would do about this. If you would pay the $3.89, if you pay more, if you pay less. The number is 877-301-8970. Let's go to, who is on the phone?
Denise.
Denise from Western Mass. Thanks for calling, Denise. What do you think?
Hi. Well, out where I live, we have a lot of farm stands in the summer. And about half of them have a cash box sitting there. And it's an honor system to pay for, you know, your vegetables. And I'm sure a lot of these people wouldn't do it if they weren't getting paid. I've actually been to a couple stands where I haven't had exact change, and they would say, oh, just give it to me next time you come. I think people, for the most part, are honest about paying their food. They know people who have to work hard to put that food there, and they deserve to get paid for it, and, you know, especially if you can afford it.
Denise, thank you for the call.
Thanks,
that's
Denise.
A great issue, too. If you feel differently about, you mentioned Macy's before, Jim, about, you know, which is a big company. Do people feel differently, Gianna, about shafting Macy's than they do about shafting the person that runs a small stand in Western Massachusetts selling tomatoes?
100%, and that's something that my research, but also a lot of other research has shown, that if it is one person, and in particular someone you can relate to, like someone from your own community, you are so much more likely to support that person rather than something like a faceless corporation, which people oftentimes assume that they're ripping off the general public in the first place. So if we leave less money for a faceless corporation, it doesn't really matter. So that is definitely an influential factor.
But one of our producers just asked, is there a rural-urban divide, which is sort of what the woman spoke to. But there's also, everything is different. I lived in New York City for 15 years. And as you both were talking, I'm trying to imagine if Panera Cares opened at 43rd and Broadway.
Forget it.
There would not be like even no fixtures left if everything was free. That is true. There is a culture, is there not? And the question is, you know the Boston culture. You're local. I don't know if you're a lifelong, but you're a local person now, Jana Eckhart from Suffolk University. Do we have the kind of culture in which, obviously they've done market research, I assume, in which something like this can flourish, can succeed?
I think probably more so than New York, but not the same as like the South, for example, which we were talking about before. So I think that what we're going to see in Boston is going to be sort of a bipolar divide. You are going to have those people who will take anything free that they can get. We have a large population of college students here, right? I think they'll probably fall into that.
You have a large population of, we were talking before about panhandlers down by Government Center. What do you do if you have, you know, 10 panhandlers coming in to, you know, have the Turkey Bravo or whatever the heck it is?
You know what you say? I say to them, I'll buy you a sandwich. And I go up to the thing.
Really, that's a big issue.
It is a huge issue. Let's go to Cape Cod, where Gerard is with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan sitting in at Boston Public Radio for today. Hey, Gerard, what's up?
Hi, Gerard.
Hey, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was a fan of Panera until I realized that their soups were too salty and had too much sodium in them for me.
Oh.
And probably for the rest of the population. But anyway, when I was a kid living in New York City, there was the honor system in the morning when you went to get a bar of candy or a newspaper. You just threw your money into a cigar box, and if you didn't have the right change, took change at. That seemed to work for the for the candy store owners back then.
Yeah, until somebody took the cigar box. That was the. How long ago was that, Gerard, if I may ask? What era was that? I'm serious. How long ago was that?
Well, that was probably in the late 50s and early 60s.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Gerard, thanks for the call. I'm sorry. What?
Go ahead.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, thank you.
It's a bad connection. I know someone who stole UNICEF money.
I did.
Halloween.
I did, but I paid it back. 40 years
later,
I actually
research.
Did.
Yeah, many children stealing UNICEF collections on Halloween.
I haven't found that yet.
No, it's pretty rare, Jim.
Let's try Woodstock, Connecticut. I may have been the person she's speaking about. Paul from Woodstock, Connecticut, you're on Boston Public Radio at 877-301-8970. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Great topic. Okay. I heard you say that nobody is watching.
Right.
Okay. However, I have seen many times it repeat itself. What goes around comes around. What you reap, you sow.
Mm-hmm.
It's in many different religions in many different ways. And it's interesting whether or not, however it presents itself, whether it's your consciousness that's putting it out there, but in terms of what you do to others, you know, the golden rule.
Exactly.
Comes back on to you. And nobody has to be watching, but somehow I've seen this time and time again.
So what's an example, Paul? Give me an example.
An example.
Yeah.
You know, an individual at work and treating you a certain way. But rather than revert back to that person, I've continued to just give him goodwill. And
gosh,
eventually what happens is this particular, you don't do anything, but you don't even wish him bad karma, but it happens. And I've seen this time and time again in I'm retired now, but throughout my work and watched it come about. You hear about it perhaps later, but eventually you reap what you sow. And
Paul, it's pretty clear I've never worked with you. That's pretty... Not to disrespect any of the people. Paul, thank you.
What an impressive group of callers here.
It's really,
all these people that are doing the right thing.
They're the aberrations. Look on your face, John Eckhart from Suffolk University, the author of The Myth of the Ethical Consumer. Yeah. They are the aberrations. I mean, you're fairly cynical. You know the great line from Lily Tomlin, no matter how cynical I get, I just can't keep up. You know that line? I love that. I mean, you are fairly cynical about this, are you not?
Well, I think of myself as a realist. I would love it if everyone walked into Panera Cares and gave the absolute maximum amount that they could.
Yeah.
But the way I look at it is we need research to be able to accurately predict what's going to happen. So I feel like I'm more of a realist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, before we let you go, Gianna, for the next Ron Shaikh who wants to do a good thing, give us like 30 seconds. What's the moral of the story? What should they look at if they decide to do a variation on this Panera Cares thing?
To be honest with you, from a marketing standpoint, appeals that don't necessarily relate to people's ethical or moral beliefs tend to be quite successful. I know that sounds paradoxical because the whole reason when you go into a Panera Cares, the point is to give. But to say, you know, we have this delicious food. People love Panera, right? That's why they're so successful. Mm-hmm. We have this delicious food that tastes great. You already love it. You know, maybe leave your extra change if you can. But in other words, keeping the message about Panera and what people already love about it. People are familiar with it. They love to get their breakfast or lunch there. That tends to be more successful than trying to make people feel like they will be a bad moral or ethical person if they don't engage in this. And so my advice to other companies that would like to emulate this is focus on what you do best.
And buy The Myth of the Ethical Consumer by Gianna
yes.
Eckhart from Suffolk University. Gianna, thank you so much for your time, and thanks to Ron Shaikh, the founder of Panera and the guy behind Panera Cares.
Very excited about this. To celebrate the 15th anniversary of a movie most of us adore, Good Will Hunting, we're going to meet a writer who interviewed the stars, Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, and the director. That's up next.
Years ago, Daniel Hernandez Jr. was hailed as a hero. He rushed to the aid of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was shot in broad daylight.
I appreciate the sentiment. I must humbly reject the use of the word hero because I am not one.
We look back on that tragic day in Tucson and to what's next for some of the people involved next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Simmons Leadership Conference on Tuesday, April 2nd, Women of Influence, a day of leadership, motivation, and networking for women seeking to compete in today's changing business climate. Info at simmons.edu/leadership. And the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, striving to provide patients with expert cancer care, innovative services, and treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
You're listening to 89.7 Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.
And this year is the 15th anniversary of a huge, huge film, particularly to Bostonians, Good Will Hunting.
Is that your thing? You come into a bar, you read some obscure passage, and then pretend you pawn it off as your own idea just to impress some girls, embarrass my friend? See, the sad thing about a guy like you is in 50 years, you're going to start doing some thinking on your own, and you're going to come up with the fact that there are two certainties in life. One, don't do that. And two, you dropped 150 grand on a f***ing education you could have got for $1.50 in late charges at the public library.
Boston Magazine's Janelle Nanos is in studio with us, smiling at that bite, by the way. She's done a 6-month oral history on the 15th anniversary, as I said, of the film, which launched local heroes, my homeboys, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, Good Will Hunting. She talked to the boys from Cambridge, to Robin Williams and the director, and now she's talking to us. Hello, Janelle Nanos.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure.
Okay, Janelle, this is almost like a joke of an assignment. It is such a dream.
It was a dream assignment,
I bet it was. So people what you did. You talked to Ben. You talked to Matt.
I did,
you talked to Robin, the director.
So, I talked to a lot of PR people first, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of reps, a lot of phone calls made out to LA and trying to convince them that this was a story worth doing. And it was. I mean, once I started connecting with people, it became really clear how passionate everyone was about making this film at the time and how passionate they really still are about it now. It's just still such an important movie, obviously, to Matt and Ben. But to everyone else who was involved, they're all really, really proud of it. So
you went to a, did you bring your tape recorder or your computer?
I did a lot of phone calls, actually. I was using, you know, basically trying to work around a lot of these people's schedules. Yep. So I actually connected with Matt Damon in, well, he was in Bucharest.
On the phone.
So on the phone, it is, there's nothing like getting a phone call on your cell phone from Matt Damon. Ladies. And we spoke for an hour and a half, and he was great. And we, you know, we lost a connection in the middle, and I was like, oh, we've got this, you know, disconnect. We're across the Atlantic. And he's like, oh, he calls me right back. And I was like, that's Matt Damon.
And for those who don't remember, obviously, it's what launched their careers, not only the movie, but they won the Academy Award for screenwriting together. We know how huge this thing is in Boston, obviously. Mm-hmm. Is it as huge around the rest of the country where there's no, I mean, Ben and Matt are huge now, but they're not from there. Is the movie a big deal everywhere else?
I think so. Yeah. I think anybody who kind of came up watching that movie at a certain time period in your life, it sort of resonates with you and you almost experienced it. It was something that Robin Williams actually told me, that many people felt like they didn't just watch the movie, they lived through it. And so, you know, riding the red line now, I always think of that one scene where, you know, Will Hunting kind of rides from MIT back to Southie. Yes. There are certain moments, for me at least, that I always think about. And I think a lot of people have those moments.
Do your friends think you were a jerk when you just dropped Matt Damon's name and Robin Williams
do.
In the conversation?
They tease me now because I say Matt and Ben like they're my friends. And, you know, I sort of felt like we had a pretty, you know, we talked for quite a while. So I felt like, you know, we didn't make a contact.
Well, we're
sure.
going to keep you smiling. Let's hear one more bite, if we can, from this great movie, 15th anniversary of Good Will Hunting.
So, you know, what is it, like Will has an attachment disorder? Is it all that stuff? Fear of abandonment? Is that why I broke up with Skylar?
I didn't know you had.
I did.
You want to talk about it?
No.
Hey, Will. I don't know a lot. You see this? This is not your fault.
Very few people have a good Boston accent in movies. I mean, they're from Cambridge, so maybe it wasn't that hard.
For them, it
really,
wasn't easy.
Yeah,
for them,
really
it was easy,
did.
Yeah.
But you don't really hear a Boston accent, even much in Boston anymore.
I
so
know.
It's amazing that they did it so well. So you talked to Matt Damon for an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
What about Ben Affleck?
Well, they told me, so I tried to get a hold of Ben in the middle of the Argo, you know, huge, sort of, it was coming out, they had all the premieres, everything was going on, and I'm like calling, making that one phone call saying, hey, can you talk to me a little bit about Good Will Hunting? And they pushed me aside. They said, he's not going to do the project. And I said, okay, I'm going to focus all my energy on Matt. And so when I did, he spoke with me for an hour and a half. I finally went back to Ben's reps and said, you know, I got Matt. He was wonderful. If I could get some time with Ben, that'd be great. And they said, okay, you have a half hour. And so they gave me a half hour. And the second I got on the phone with Ben, I said, you know, this is great. I'm really excited. Matt and I talk for an hour and a half, so I can just get whatever you can give me, and that'd be wonderful. And he's like, I'm calling you back. And sure enough, after a half hour on the phone with him, he's like, I'll call you in 2 hours. And he called me back, and we had another hour-long conversation. And they were great. It was wonderful sort of being able to say, oh, well, Matt told me this, and then Ben would sort of rebut. And you can see that, how that sort of came out in the piece. There was many moments where Ben sort of checked Matt's, you know, sort of gushy feelings about it. I love the part where Ben talks about, you know, how they cried after they shot the first scene. And,
yeah.
And Ben's just like, oh, come on. What is he saying that for?
You know, I'm sitting here listening to Janelle Nanos from Boston Magazine. You're talking to Ben and Matt and Robin. Marjorie and I are interviewing guys who own 7-Elevens in Somerville. Our number is 877-301-8970. If you have any recollections, I saw Robin Williams perform once. I thought the single fastest mind that I've ever seen in my life. And the sense I had, based on no personal experience, is this guy can never shut it off. Meaning he is exactly who he is in life as he is on stage. When you talk to Robin Williams, am I right? Or is he a semi-normal human being?
He was really reserved when I actually
really?
Had him on the phone. I was surprised. I've been told that he goes through lots of highs and lows, but he was pretty reserved. You could tell that the movie meant a lot to him. He compared it to Awakenings and Dead Poets Society, mm-hmm. two other films that he actually had very dramatic roles in. And, you know, he did break out a few moments there where I said, you know, what if we made Good Will Hunting the musical? And he starts singing and coming up with, like, you know, these,
great.
It's not your fault, it's not your fault. And I was dying. But, I mean, it was a passion project for him, too. He saw the script. And he loved it immediately, and he thought the character was so wise, and, you know, knowing that it was written by these kids, I mean, they were in their 20s at the time.
Well, you have a great anecdote, and by the way, so people know what we're talking about, it is the 15th anniversary of the film Good Will Hunting. It was co-written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, both Cambridge kids. You have a great anecdote about how it came to be written Matt Damon started this when he was at Harvard. What happened?
He started it as, well, he was assigned to do a one-act play by Anthony Kubiak, who was a Harvard professor at the time. And he ended up writing what was not really a one-act play, but more of sort of the start of a screenplay. He handed him about 40 pages and actually reached out to Anthony and asked him, you know, what did you think? And he said, you could tell. There was a voice there. There were ideas and thoughts. And he's like, Matt said, I may have failed your class, but I think this is something more. And Anthony said, yeah, you should pursue it. And so he took it out to L.A. when he was visiting Ben. Ben was at Occidental College at the time.
Uh-huh.
And the two just started working on it in their living room. Matt was staying on Ben's couch. The two of them were, you know, basically acting out scenes, drinking beers, recording it into a tape recorder and doing all the voices at the time.
Why did it take Matt Damon 5 years to get through Harvard? What was he doing in that fifth year?
He was acting.
He was
going out to L.A. and he was taking roles at
okay.
the time.
So it wasn't he was flunking all his courses.
No. He had just gotten a role in Geronimo.
Okay.
An American Legend, I think. So
let's hear another little piece of this.
Yeah. So
here's the scene where Matt Damon and Minnie Driver's character break up in this great film.
You live in this safe little world where no one challenges you and you're scared shitless to do anything
else.
Don't
tell me about my world. Don't tell me about my world. I mean, you just want to have your little fling with, like, the guy from the other side of town. Then you're going to go off to Stanford. You're going to marry some rich prick who your parents will approve of and just sit around with the other trust fund babies and talk about how you went slumming too once.
Reading your thing, I thought, you know, if you had done this a year ago on the 14th anniversary, I'm serious, it would have been totally different. Damon was this huge star.
Mm-hmm.
People were still saying Affleck, well, okay, but he never lived up. And now you have Argo.
Mm-hmm.
And Affleck, this rising star, I mean, rising, it's sort of strange to say that, is the talk of Hollywood, the talk of filmdom across the world. No?
It's true. No, absolutely. And there were many points talking with Ben Affleck about, you know, making this film, Good Will Hunting, where he was talking about how he built those things into Argo. So much of what he learned making this film, he brought to Argo. He said, you know, there was a point where they fought over the director, and that actually caused them to leave Castle Rock and take it to Miramax at the time. You know, and in those conversations, he said that he brought up the idea of actually directing Good Will Hunting, which would have been another huge accomplishment on their part if they had. Everyone, of course, thought at the time it was crazy, but now you can see that, you know, he could have actually done it.
One last question. What's, of all the interviews you did, all the moments on this 6-month oral history deal you did with all these great people from this great film, what's the one that sticks with you the most, Janelle Nanos?
It was getting Matt. Matt was obviously
look at the smile on her face, Margaret, as we're having this conversation.
If you had told me 15 years ago I would be interviewing Matt Damon for the story, I would, yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, getting Matt and then hearing him talk about how passionate it was. He said it would, you know, nothing else would ever change his life like this movie again, and it's true.
Great movie, great piece, Janelle Nanos, Boston Magazine. You did great work, Janelle.
You absolutely
Thank
did.
You very
keep on
much.
Smiling.
I hope your other assignments can somehow be at least half as great as
me
this
too.
One. Thank you very much for being with us,
Thank
Janelle.
Thank you so much for having
now,
me.
Now, Marjorie, after 100, I did the math while Janelle was speaking,
uh-huh.
146 hours in radio exile. And then thanks to Callie Crossley, Emily Rooney and their team at Boston Public Radio, we were able to sit in today here at 89.7 for 2 hours, and it was great.
Well, I hope so. Was it good for you, Jim?
There were moments that were good for me. The notion of being able to go to Panera and getting my usual combo for maybe $2-3 is really compelling. If you want to follow us and find out where we are next, you can go to Twitter, at Jim Browdy and at Marjorie Egan. Marjorie is just starting to tweet, and I have to say, they have been excellent.
That's
Thanks
right.
to everybody here.
Thank you.